name is Dan Brown. Today, we are talking to Andy Fitzgerald for A Lens a Day, Conversations about Information Architecture. Andy, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me, Dan.
So I'm excited to talk process with you. I'm excited to try and, because you are also a very, from what I've seen of your work and your talks, a very nuts and bolts information architect. And I'm really curious about how do you get your arms around the design problem, especially from an IA perspective? I have a specific interest in collaboration, like how do we help other people along with that process? But whether that's important to you or not, I'm really curious, just what are some of the ways in which you get your arms around the design problem that you're dealing with in IA?
Mm-hmm. Good question. To a very short answer, struggle and spreadsheets.
Two of my favorite things. Yes.
Yes. They don't lend themselves very well to collaboration. So I don't recommend collaborating in spreadsheets, but looking at a problem and knowing that I know a project is going to be interesting when I sign it and we kick off and I start in on it. And then I go, oh shit, what did I get myself into? I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea what this is going to look like, no idea how I'm going to solve it. And when I first started consulting independently, this was a problem because then I'd panic. But then I figured out like, no, well, I shouldn't know beforehand. That's why they hired me. If I knew beforehand, then they could have known beforehand. So that idea of embracing and really being comfortable with the struggle has been, I think, really helpful in being able to get my arms around stuff. And go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is there like a particular moment where that panic really sets in? Like, is there a conversation that's happening? Is it just sort of immersing yourself in the domain? What is it that you feel like for you kind of tips you over the edge from I got this to, oh shit?
I think it's immersing myself in the domain. And then, and there's kind of a when I begin to immerse myself in the domain, that moment where I'm like, oh, it's okay to be confused right now. I'm just, you know, coming up to speed on this. But then when I realize that I've put myself on the hook to create some solutions and try and solve some problems, then it kind of starts to hit. But once I sort of realized that the panic was okay because I have tools and I have techniques and I've got, you know, the things that all this community has created that I can draw on to solve the problems, like it stopped really being a problem per se, but there is still this idea of wrestling with ambiguity that I will note on a side note. I mean, when I'm sure this has come up in your other conversations as well, but if you're an information architecture content strategy, there is always new stuff to learn. And you're always learning stuff. And I've been working with actually the like real nuts and bolts in building content schemas and headless content management systems. And I've had to learn some stuff that I'll get into it. And I'm like, I've got no business trying to do this. But then just sitting with that ambiguity and wrestling with it and then being comfortable, being way out of my depth and having no idea what I'm doing, but pushing through it has been, I think that's probably the most important thing I've learned about getting my head around those kinds of problems.
I want to come back to that because I really like the idea of being comfortable with the ambiguity. You mentioned tools and techniques. I guess from a pragmatic perspective, is there one that you gravitate towards, especially maybe if you've got a complex domain and you're still just kind of getting your arms around it? What are some of the tools that you pull out of the toolbox to kind of help you with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did mention very flatly spreadsheets at the beginning.
Yes.
That's one that I keep coming back to. So there are lots of other tools like content mapping tools. I really like Screaming Frog, for instance. I like Figma for being able to grab screenshots of ideas and put them into structures and lay them out and be able to see the big picture. I like my whiteboard, and you know, sometimes this room will be covered in sticky notes and whiteboard markings. So like all of these ways of, it's really of externalizing the structure so that I can get a broader view of the landscape so that I'm not looking at a single page or a single interaction or a single user need or a single pathway, but that I can step back and kind of see how the whole thing fits together. So that externalizing it, and then the spreadsheets are a way of putting that structure back together And one of the, I taught, last time we had an in-person IA summit, I taught a workshop on structured content design. And we did a lot in spreadsheets. And one of the things that I wanted to teach was how to actually use spreadsheets. So the formulas, the filtering, creating well-structured data that you can then mine for insight, they're actually, I hate to admit it, because like English major Andy is like digging on spreadsheets and it kills the 20-year-old me like every time, but they're really powerful tools and they're ubiquitous. Everybody's got them and there are tons of tutorials out there. So I would say like learning how to actually structure and use a spreadsheet has been an important, definitely an important step.
When you, that's awesome. I'm also a fan of spreadsheets and I was a philosophy major.
You feel the pain.
I mean, I do sometimes wonder like, okay, if I go back 30 years and I show that guy what I'm doing today and where I work and what I do, would he just be like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into?
Yeah, what have I become?
So do you find that there is, when you teach people about how to really use a spreadsheet, how to really kind of take advantage of the power, especially with the kinds of problems that we are dealing with, is there one thing that clicks for them? Is there one sort of aha moment where they're like, oh, now I understand what we're trying to do here?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. And I think the moment is realizing that your spreadsheet is just a set, all the rows are objects and all of the columns are values on those objects. And if, when you start to mix more than one value per cell, so per column, now you can't do anything with the data, because you're mixing in multiple schemas in your spreadsheet. But if you break them out, if instead of having a list of names and then in the column male, female, male, female, male, female, you're actually mixing data. You're mixing the individual and their gender in that same column. So it's like teaching people how to break out the data so that every value is discrete. Now you can do tons of stuff. You can do pivot tables and apply formulas and filters and everything else. But it's getting to the granularity that's the hard part. And then everything else after that, it works.
And why that is so important is I feel like part of our jobs is to be sort of the, let's call it the diplomat that sits in between how people use and consume and engage with content and how to get that content into a machine so that the machine can manipulate it and push it out in a way that's meaningful for the people. Mm-hmm. And by playing that diplomat role, we have to sort of interpret like, okay, I get that in your head, you mush these two pieces of information together, but in order for the system to make use of it, we need to pull those two pieces of information apart. And helping folks who are in charge of content kind of build that bridge, like sort of understand that dissociation of information, I think is part of the challenge of information architecture. Have you run into that?
Yeah, definitely. There's a metaphor I like to use in that humans, carbon-based beings, and computers, so the silicon, so the carbon and the silicon are fundamentally incompatible. Humans are associative, approximate, and heuristic. We use best practices, we muddle through, we find approximations. See, there, just did it. Well, you know what I mean. We find these approximations of everything, and it allows us to get mostly right most of the time. And that's what makes us successful. Computers are exact, enumerative, and exhaustive. It's completely, they're diametrically opposed. A computer is never going to get close enough and be like, that's done, it's 5 o'clock, right? It's going to go all the way to the end of whatever program it is. It's going to resolve in a one or a zero at the end of the day. So like these two systems do not fit. They're like a square peg and a watermelon, right? It just doesn't, they just don't go together. So bridging that gap, and like you said, like finding the structures and then putting them, much like finding the structure in our complex world that will work in a spreadsheet, is a lot of what we do, and maybe this is why we like them, is a lot of what we do in finding a structure that will work in a content management system or a knowledge graph, right? Or a set of interconnected RDF stores or something.
Is there an IA challenge that you are working on right now that that you can share with us?
Yes. There are a couple, and I was trying to decide which one I could share.
Okay, yeah, go for it.
I'm just wrapping up a piece of work for an organization within the World Health Organization, and they're working on structuring their content so that people will find it and browse it. And part of the interest and challenge in something like that, and actually I like to work with mission-driven organizations, so hospitals, healthcare organizations, university. So the kinds of things where success for them isn't gauged on how many page hits they get or how many, you know, widgets they sell. It's based on people actually understanding their content and getting the information. So this is part of what's fun about governments too, is that governments often have all sorts of services and benefits for people that they, if they could just tell people about how to access them, they would be successful. So they just need to get that information out. So in this case, the challenge was not so much, one of the things that they've been focused on was how do we increase our traffic? And actually, but they don't, like most organizations, they don't need more traffic. They just need the right traffic. And if they get fewer visitors, but a greater percentage of those are the right visitors, you know, the people they're trying to reach with their message, that's success for them because they're getting that message where it needs to go. So that comes back to, I'm sorry, I kind of went way off track on that answer, but that comes a little bit back to that playing the diplomat a little bit. I think there's, for things like Google Analytics and some other metrics that are freely available but poorly understood, there's a lot of more is better. I was asked the other day by someone on the client team, in all earnestness, with the best of intentions, what should our number of page visitors be? Is it better or is it worse than others? And I'm just like, right, what do you want? I mean, what are you trying to accomplish? So there are these metrics and the success gates that people have, but as in this case, they're often disconnected from the goals. So that's, I guess, another piece of the diplomat there.
I feel like that kind of brings us nicely to the lens that we picked out, that this IA challenge that you are working on is very much about helping people find what they need. And one of the ways that they might do that is show up to the site and take a look at the range of content that's available there. Mm-hmm. So can you share with us the lens that we picked and what about spoke to you?
Yeah. So browsability was the lens. I have it here. And this, do you want me to read it?
It is up to you. Maybe say it in your own words.
In my own words.
Yeah.
So browsability in my sense, well, is how the ability, our I wouldn't say our ability, but our propensity to survey our environment and see what's out there. One of the examples that I like to use, and as I just gave the example of a mission-driven organization who has a set of content that they want to communicate. And one of the things that's really exciting to me about those kinds of organizations now is sometimes they'll communicate them on their websites, but sometimes they won't. For example, I think it was in 2018, Rand Fishkin of, used to be Moz, his new company's name escapes me, but he did some research and found that the click-through rate of Google search results page dropped below 50%, which means that 50% of people who do a Google search result never leave the search results page. And there are, Spark Toro is the name of the company. He then hypothesized some reasons that might be, but one of them is that Google is surfacing content right on the search engine result page, so you don't actually have to click through. And for many organizations, this idea of we don't need to get people to our page, we need to communicate our message, is now that there's linked data and different ways to surface content to search algorithms or voice algorithms, you can communicate that in ways that go beyond simply making a page that someone has to go to, which is information architects is just a whole, like that's squarely our work. And that's a whole new realm of thinking about how we help communicate. The other side, so that idea of browsability and our thirst and interest in taking in information is now not only about browsing navigation and browsing a web page, but how do we design the content structures under the covers of that web page so that they can be browsed by algorithms, so they can be browsed by voice interfaces, so they can be browsed by hopefully responsible aggregators that can pull up information and, for example, give you a reliable, trustworthy comparison of tuitions at different universities. So that's one side of browsability. The other side of browsability, of course, is that we're greedy, greedy monkeys. And there are a lot of interfaces on the web. Social media is certainly one of them that has tapped into this, that are an endless bag of potato chips. And you have like the infinite scrolls that we just go back for one more and one more. And there you've got browsability gone amok because we get to the end of it. And well, I mean, it's not the only thing to blame for some of the perils besetting our current state of culture, but it's certainly a contributing factor, I would think. So a very broad discussion of this lens.
No, but it's really, and that's I think the point is just sort of adopt a perspective and then see what it reveals to you. Have you made use of this lens in your own work? Can you think of a time when maybe you were sort of looking at a structure you were designing and thinking, what can I do to help people feel or appeal to that that greedy monkey inside of us or our capacity to kind of survey the world around us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in this World Health Organization project, for instance, one of the things that I helped them do is redesign their top level application. And the World Health Organization website is a very large site with many thousands of pages and hundreds of subsites. And I was helping to work on one of those subsites. And so they have their global page navigation and then the local subsite navigation underneath it. And that's what they can control. So one of the things in helping them lead site visitors to discover what it is that they do and understand it in the way that they wish it to be understood was thinking about what those labels are and what the categories of things that go under the labels are. And so we played with in thinking about browsability and how even the browsing structure itself tells a person what's there. One of the things that we found in looking at some analytics, oddly enough, is that people tended to click through the top level navigation and never go any further in the site. And one hypothesis, I think, for why that might be is they're trying to figure out what's in each of those categories or what these things are. So the labels themselves weren't super clear. And then once they got there, they're like, oh, okay, that's not what I want. And then move to the next thing. Maybe that's a hypothesis. But designing those orthogonal categories, so things that don't overlap, but then also tuning the narrative of those categories to what this particular subsite of the World Health Organization wanted to communicate. And in their case, they are a group that is responsible for a certain set of diseases. And the easiest way to structure their site is to give people a list of the diseases and then go look at them. They're all horrible, by the way. But what they want to emphasize is that the strategies used to combat these diseases cut across these categories. So simply by giving people a list of the diseases, they miss the major part of that narrative. So the idea, now at the same time, in terms of thinking about browsability and how we can tap into people's natural thirst for knowledge and information, we want to be able to present, and in this case, the ability to, yes, browse by disease, but then also introduce, enticing targets to help people understand what it is that this group is trying to communicate.
Yeah, I find, I love what you're saying, and that example really resonates with me because I find as an IA, I end up doing this a lot with my hands. We're dealing with sets of categories that are orthogonal to each other, and the intersections are very interesting, But to really understand the whole picture, you need to see both of these dimensions. But to see both of those dimensions is to put a lot of stuff on a page. And I think, you know, there's sort of a diminishing returns in terms of browsability, right? We sort of, we want to put a lot of things for you to look at and engage with and get a survey of, but if we put too many things, then you also lose track of the picture as well. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I really like, and I find that I often quote Nielsen Norman Group study that talks about depth in clicks. And basically they do, and the Nielsen, like that is another incredible tool and resource I go to all the time, is the Nielsen Norman Group. And this particular study, they talk about this idea that I can't count, and I'm sure you can't either, the number of projects I've been on where like everything has to be accessible from the homepage, right? Really? Are you sure? Everything? I don't think you want that. Nobody really wants that. But the idea of, and maybe this is an important piece of the browsability question as well, that each of those clicks feels purposeful. And each of those clicks feels like you're going in the right direction is much more important than everything being three clicks, because then you get that bizarre and bizarre homepage where everything is just stuffed in there.
Yes. Yeah. On intranets too, this is
happening
a lot, where they like, well, we've got to show this, but we're going to give you a list of quick links too. Yeah. Like, you understand that that's a symptom of a problem. Yeah. Not a solution. Yeah. And so what I get is not so much everything needs to be on, I mean, I get everything needs to be on the homepage, but somewhere along the way, it was everything needs to be within three clicks.
Yeah.
And so I had not realized that was a Nielsen Norman thing, but I love, so I talk about not quantity of clicks, but quality.
Absolutely. Clicks. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I wanted to get back to something you had said earlier. Hang on. Comfortable with ambiguity. Mm-hmm. I've been asking folks about what advice they would give to designers who may be just starting out or maybe don't have a lot of experience with information architecture. And I really appreciated this thought that you put out there, that IAs perhaps maybe more than other aspects of user experience need to embrace the ambiguity, need to understand that that comes with the job. So let me put these two things together. What advice would you offer someone who is maybe just starting out, maybe new to IA, who maybe doesn't quite feel so comfortable with the ambiguity? How do you help someone like that?
So two things come to mind. One, Abby Covert has a very delightful article, as are all of her articles, about, so you've decided you want to be an IA. And it's actually a long article, which not all of her articles are. She goes into depth about this and she explores it. If for one who thinks that IA is the path they want to go down, it's definitely worth a read. The other one is, do you want to be in a position where you are always learning new stuff? And where that learning often is self-motivated and self-driven. If so, IA is probably the one for you. If not, maybe consider what you're getting yourself into, I guess. And this is just the way I approach it, and maybe not everybody's like this, but so being comfortable with the ambiguity. I have another colleague, Tamara Adlin, who wrote some very huge persona books that are amazing and wonderful, and she's an incredible person. Who has this idea of two books, 2 days. If you're applying for a job and you say, I don't have those skills, are there skills you could teach yourself by reading two books? And maybe it's more than 2 days, maybe it's 2 weeks. I don't quite remember what it is. But being comfortable diving in, reading books, exploring stuff. And for me, it's reading books. For other people, it might be podcasts, or it might be a lecture series, or courses or whatever else. But that the ambiguity, being comfortable with it. And I think once you start to learn a couple things, for example, I'm looking over at my bookshelf, and Designing Connected Content by Carrie Hain and Mike Atherton gives you a really practical way to think about designing connected content and what that looks like. Once you start to get your head around that and then a couple other things, for me anyway, it started to become apparent that, hey, if once I decide that I don't know something and I think it's important that I do know it, it can be learned. One can learn it. So depending on what it is, it takes a very amount of effort, but being willing just to say like, I have no idea how to, like for me, it was dealing with this headless content management system. I needed to learn how to use React.
Right.
And I was just like, React is, I know nothing about it. So I took a weekend, dove in and like learned the basics of it and then grappled with it for a couple of weeks. And now I'm able to, now I can build these schemas. But that was one of those things where I'm like, why am I doing this? I have no business doing this. This is crazy. But it was learnable. And once you learn a couple of things are learnable, you're like, you know, you pick and choose your battles. But
I think that is so important to be able to embrace not just the ambiguity, but the fact that you're not going to ever master this, right? Like, yeah. You know, I'm not ever going to, no offense, but I'm never going to come to Andy Fitzgerald for React programming, right? But but when you sort of say, all right, well, this is a means to an end, right? Or I just need to learn this enough to solve the bigger problem, right? It gives yourself permission to not be, you know, the best React programmer on the block or in the room.
Too. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's, and with that, there's some tension there, and I choose the things that I want to pick up carefully, because some of them is realizing what my strength is and not wanting to take, I don't know why I have this metaphor, because I'm not a sportball fan, but not wanting to take my game onto someone else's ball field.
Right.
I will never bid on a React project or even a visual design project. Because those are things where people who are steeped in those think about those as much as I think about information architecture. Right. So it's realizing where your core and where your strength is, just based on your interests, I think, for me anyway. But then not being afraid to sort of, you know, go play a visitor game. I don't know why I'm using this metaphor. And explore that. And that, I think, is, well, learning more about the DOM and learning more about JavaScript helped me understand the hierarchy and the structure that underlies everything we do on the web. And that's made me a better information architect. It's meant that I could do a couple nuts and bolts things in setting up content schemas. But more importantly, it's helped me understand what those systems need from me.
And I think we will leave it there. Andy, thank you so much for joining me on this.
Thanks for having me.